Okay, these days, if it's difficult to find a producer to fund a film, a lot of artists turn to crowdsourcing sites like Kickstarter for money. But here's a new twist. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on a project that's crowdsourcing for artistic inspiration.
Directors get a lot of credit for great films. Hitchcock, Godard, Scorsese, Bigelow are auteurs, creative visionaries. On that list, some might include Ron Howard, the Academy Award-winning director of films such as Apollo 13.
The clock is running!
Houston, we have cleared the tower.
Howard sees his films as the work of many, many creative people.
Any film that I've ever done, as much as I like to put my stamp on it, take command of it, it's still influenced by so many collaborators.
From screenwriters, cinematographers, designers, and other creative professionals. But Howard says now he also finds ideas on the internet, doing searches of history sites or watching home videos made in places he's never been.
People are far more creative than perhaps they give themselves credit for, and when they're willing to put themselves up front and center and share their creativity, it's stimulating. It's exciting for them, and it can stimulate others in their imagination.
So when Canon, the camera and film equipment maker, approached Howard about heading up a project that tapped the public for creativity, he said yes. It's called Project Imagination. The idea is to get people to contribute photos that will be used as the inspiration for 5 short films. Howard asked for 10 kinds of photos based on the essential elements of a narrative, stuff like mood, setting, obstacle, character.
It was interesting to take those ideas, which are a little on the abstract side, and see how people would apply images to those words.
Howard and his staff whittled down the entries, and then a group of directors whittled them down further. All the directors were chosen by Howard and their first-timers, among them actors Jamie Foxx and Eva Longoria. Also, Biz Stone, no more for being the co-founder of Twitter than an artist.
Cut.
Today, Stone's on the set at a ranch in Los Angeles trying to shoot his film.
The battery died on that, so we might not have that taken.
It's really hard with the wind.
We'll go again.
Stone's got a crew of professionals around him to help, and Ron Howard is mentoring him. Before the shooting began, Stone locked himself away with the 10 photos and used them as touch points for the screenplay he wrote. Each photo is connected to the plot. Among the pictures is a sad old man on a bench looking at the ground and a close-up shot of an ant.
And I imagine that he might be looking at that ant and empathizing with this ant that looks lost and meandering without purpose.
Stone imagined the old man was sad because his wife killed herself by drowning. One of the other photos is a fully dressed woman underwater. He used the photos taken by people he's never met to come up with a story of a family pulled apart by a suicide. Stone feels like the method he's using to make this film fits in with the way he hoped social media would change the world. For example, he thinks photo sharing sites are proving that you don't have to be a professional to be an artist.
I think there's a lot of things that we think are new that have always been happening, and it's just we know about them now.
Stone and other social media entrepreneurs are also a threat to the traditional Hollywood model. Nick Childs, a filmmaker and creative director at Fleischmann Hillard, thinks audiences are no longer content to sit around waiting for the next movie by their favorite director with their favorite star. He says there's a lot of pressure to involve audiences, but it can go too far.
Where suddenly you're pleasing so many different people, or there's so many pieces trying to be told that you're not doing the work that a movie needs, which is a discrete viewpoint, making decisions to do this, not that, not everything for everyone.
Childs has seen a few successful projects, such as the one by the Academy Award-winning director Kevin MacDonald, which pulled together videos taken on one day by different people around the world. The 90-minute documentary, A Life in a Day, got nearly 34 million views on YouTube. Director Ron Howard says he's been amazed at the creativity being unleashed online from everyone from the home repair wizard to the young comedian. He thinks Hollywood can't ignore it.
I think it's an absolute movement, and I think the people who don't embrace it are kind of not paying attention, because when you look at the internet and you look at democratization of creativity, look what people are capable of creating.
The 5 films overseen by Howard will be shown during a film festival in October. For now, Biz Stone is back in Silicon Valley, where he says he finds programmers a lot easier to work with than actors because they're more predictable. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Bitcoin is a virtual currency that's traded largely online. It was created in 2009 in the aftermath of the global financial crisis as an alternative to currencies which are controlled by countries and central bankers. But Bitcoin has been on a wild ride lately, soaring in value during the anxious days of the Cyprus banking crisis. We're going to look at the currency's history in today's Business Bottom Line. Here's NPR's Steve Henn.
The money supply in the U.S. economy is controlled by the Fed. In Europe, the number of euros flowing through the financial system is dictated by the European Central Bank. But Bitcoin, this cyber currency, is different. Bitcoins are mined. Well, kind of.
My name is Chris Koss, and I'm a Bitcoin miner, and I've been mining Bitcoin since about August of 2011.
But Chris Koss doesn't wield a pickaxe.
I'm walking into my room right now, and I'll sit down next to my computer. And you can hear that there's a pretty good humming going on right now.
Roughly every 10 minutes, the Bitcoin network creates a kind of code. And then Bitcoin miners, like Koss, race to crack it open.
Basically, you want your computer to just run through as many random guesses as possible, as quickly as possible.
The first miner to crack the code gets 25 brand new Bitcoins. Coins that didn't exist before. And at today's exchange rate, those coins are worth more than $3,000. This process of mining new Bitcoins is the only way the currency is created. And it's completely predictable. Roughly every 10 minutes, 25 new Bitcoins come into circulation. And that stability, say Bitcoin advocates, gives the currency real value.
It's similar to gold in the sense that there's a limited supply of Bitcoin and there's a limited supply of gold.
Patrick Merck is a lawyer and the general counsel at the Bitcoin Foundation. And in the last 4 years, little markets have grown up around this currency. Merck lets his clients pay their bills with it. Blogging sites accept it. So do a few restaurants and even some hotels. And like gold, recently, Bitcoin has attracted speculators.
We've seen $250,000 open market orders. We've seen $500,000 open market orders.
In the past 2 months, as the banking crisis in Cyprus has simmered, Bitcoin's value has surged, almost quadrupling. And for guys like Chris Koss, that's been, well, a bit of a bonanza.
I have all of my money except for what I plan to spend in the next month in Bitcoin.
Basically, Chris Koss's entire life savings is now locked up in a cyber currency that's barely 4 years old. Ken Kuttner, an economics professor at Williams College, says this kind of behavior has all the earmarks of a bubble.
The only possible thing that can really be driving the price rise is an expected future price rise.
Kuttner points out that Bitcoins don't pay a dividend, and unlike a dollar, you can't buy much with them.
You value a dollar because you can take it down to the corner store and buy yourself a can of Coke.
With Bitcoin, probably not.
My understanding is it's used by a small cadre of technophiles and perhaps people in the shadier side of the economy.
Today, even many Bitcoin enthusiasts like Chris Koss say they lose sleep trying to predict when or if a Bitcoin panic could wipe their assets out.
I definitely have probably gotten a couple gray hairs thinking about just where should the price be? Is it about to pop at any moment?
Bitcoins took root in a little corner of cyberspace, in part because of distrust of central bankers. But in a panic, central bankers can step in and prop up the market. They can save a life savings. Still, Koss says he's keeping his assets in Bitcoin, at least through the end of the week. Steve Hunt, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green. Today in your health, more than 36 million Americans have some degree of hearing loss. Many of those people would find life easier if they used hearing aids, but most people who would benefit from hearing aids still don't use them. NPR's John Hamilton reports on some technological advances that make today's hearing aids vastly superior to those of just a few years ago.
For someone who is hard of hearing, a radio interview can take a little extra work. For one thing, you have to get a hearing aid to work with headphones.
If by any chance I can get it a little bit louder in my left ear, that would be great.
Richard Einhorn lives in New York. He's a composer. Einhorn says until a couple of years ago, his ears weren't just good, they were golden.
I was the kind of person who would walk into a space, clap my hands once, and be able to decide whether or not I could record a symphony orchestra there and have it sound good.
Then, one morning in 2010, Einhorn woke up and realized everything had changed.
instantly I knew something was horribly wrong. There was an enormous violent buzzing in my ears, unbelievably loud, and I realized that my right ear had gone completely deaf.
Einhorn was experiencing a rare problem called sudden deafness. He would never get back any useful hearing in his right ear, and sounds in his left ear remained very faint. So Einhorn bought a top-of-the-line digital hearing aid for his left ear. He also invested in devices that help him talk on the phone, listen to live music, and carry on conversations in noisy restaurants. Einhorn says the solutions aren't perfect, but they're pretty good.
I compose every day. I see my friends. I go to movies. I go to concerts. I do everything.
All that would have been a lot harder if Einhorn had lost his hearing just a couple of decades ago. Back then, most hearing aids were still analog devices with severe limitations. But in the digital age, hearing aids and so-called assistive listening devices have become smaller, smarter, and much more powerful. Matthew Backey directs the government's Rehabilitation Engineering Research Center on Hearing Enhancement.
I started in hearing aid research in the 80s. We were working at that time at the City University of New York on a digital hearing aid. The digital hearing aid was the size of a refrigerator.
But like all things digital, it shrank fast. By the 1990s, digital hearing aids had gotten small enough to wear behind the ear. And Backey, who is also on the faculty at Gallaudet University, says since then they've addressed many of the problems that plagued earlier devices. Problems like sounds that are very loud.
In the old days, with an analog hearing aid, if something got too loud, you got distortion.
Not anymore. Digital sound processing also cut down on the annoying squawks caused by feedback, and modern hearing aids are programmed to amplify only those sound frequencies a person has trouble hearing. Backey says the latest units even know which direction a sound is coming from.
Typically, there's a bubble of amplification in front of you and some suppression behind you.
Which is more or less what our own ears are designed to do. Backey says features like directional listening are possible because today's hearing aids are controlled by tiny computers that analyze and manipulate sound. This allows them to do things like reduce the drone of an air conditioner while amplifying speech sounds. Larry Medwetsky is an audiologist at Gallaudet who lost most of his hearing when he was 3. He didn't get hearing aids until he was 13, and they were the analog type. Medwetsky says his hearing aids helped in quiet rooms, but when things got noisy, he had to turn them off. And he says they didn't amplify the full spectrum of audible sound.
The newer hearing aids have a much broader bandwidth, so to me, I'm able to hear the instruments better. I'm hearing a richness that I never heard before.
Medwetsky says he uses ear molds that fill the ear canal. That's the best solution for people like him with hearing loss that affects the entire range of sound frequencies. But most people with age-related hearing loss only need to boost high-frequency sounds, and they can use so-called open-fit hearing aids, which leave much of the ear canal open. Medwetsky says that allows low-frequency sounds to enter the ear naturally. It also prevents sounds from getting trapped, so hearing aid users no longer hear their own voice sounding like it's inside a barrel.
One of the reasons why people returned hearing aids in the past is that they did not like how their own voice sounded. And so this is a technology that's made a tremendous difference, and it's become now the prominent type of hearing aid style. It allows you to hear what you need to hear and not to block what you don't need, you know, amplified.
Other hearing aid advances include units that can receive Bluetooth audio from a cell phone and waterproof devices that can be worn swimming. But hearing aids still have their limitations. Richard Einhorn, the composer, says he misses the subtle, everyday sounds he used to find comforting. Sounds like the swish of a towel landing in a laundry hamper.
When I do hear them through a hearing aid, they sound wrong. They sound harsh and they sound tinny rather than comforting.
And Einhorn says hearing aids still don't work well in every environment.
We have huge expectations that hearing aids will solve all our hearing problems. But for specific situations, like restaurant listening, like listening in a classroom to your teacher, hearing aids need to be augmented with additional devices.
Like microphones that can be placed close to the source of a sound. Einhorn says the problem with microphones on hearing aids is that they are often too far away. He made a recording to demonstrate the problem this causes when he's trying to have a conversation in a noisy place. The woman you can just barely hear is Dana Mulvaney, who often writes about the challenges faced by people who are hard of hearing. Here's what she sounds like when Einhorn moves the microphone closer.
And it took about a year to realize that I had hearing loss in both ears.
Einhorn says when he has lunch with friends, he often gives each of them a microphone to wear around their neck. A special device sends the signal from these microphones directly to his good ear. But that technology can't help in other situations, like when he's trying to hear directions at a subway booth. Fortunately, New York subway booths have started using an old technology known as a loop system. It takes sounds from a microphone inside the booth and broadcasts it to a receiver called a telecoil, or T-coil, found in most hearing aids. Einhorn says it makes a big difference.
Take the 1 train to 14th Street, get off and get the L train to Bedford. That's heading towards Brooklyn.
T-coil technology is also available in some theaters. Einhorn says the first time he tried it was during a performance of the musical Wicked. He says he'd tried using his hearing aids at other musical performances, but the result had been painfully bad.
So basically, I was expecting to have a miserable time, and instead, I was absolutely enthralled. I had a wonderful time. I loved the musical. It was simply the first time in over a year that I'd been able to enjoy a live musical performance, and I was reduced to tears.
Kristen Rausch, an audiologist at Gallaudet, says T-coils can also help with cell phone calls, if you choose the right phone. Rausch says the Federal Communications Commission requires cell phone makers to indicate whether a particular phone is compatible with hearing aids.
There's also a T rating, which stands for the telecoil rating, and that rating is 1 to 4, and the higher that number is, the more compatible that cell phone is with a hearing aid.
Rausch says there's one thing technology can't overcome, people's reluctance to use hearing aids.
They associate it with, you know, getting older or them being the first person in their cohort to get hearing aids, and it's something that they are concerned about. But hearing aids have gotten a lot smaller. They can do a lot more things. So I don't actually see that as much anymore. I see a lot of people coming in now that are just really looking for what's the best that they can have.
The best doesn't come cheap, though. State-of-the-art hearing aids can cost $3,000. Each. John Hamilton, NPR News.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Ah, Game of Thrones. I'm hooked. The Lannisters, the Starks, the Dragon Eggs, and the Iron Throne. This is what more than 1 million fans across the world heard when they downloaded the premiere episode of Season 3. They did it illegally the day after it aired and set the dubious record for the most people sharing a single download simultaneously. Game of Thrones is the HBO fantasy series based on writer George R.R. Martin's epic novels A Song of Ice and Fire. Last year, the show was named the most illegally downloaded television show on Torrent Freak. That's a blog that reports about the latest trends on file sharing. Here to talk about what all this online piracy means for the future of TV is Graham McMillan. He's a writer for Wired.com, and he joins us now. Thanks for being with us, Graham.
Hello there.
So many people are crazy for this show. More than 1 million people downloading it after its premiere this season, last Sunday night. That's a lot of dragon eggs, Graham.
It's a lot of people who are very interested in seeing it immediately, which is one of the things that people are very focused on in terms of piracy, the seeing it immediately and not waiting for it to air in their particular location.
So who are these Game of Thrones pirates and where do they live?
They are international. The majority of people for this particular episode were actually American, which is a first. Previously, they have been predominantly Australian, oddly enough.
So I have to pay HBO to watch this show. According to your reports, HBO has been a little bit off topic about all these millions of illegal downloads, yes?
Traditionally, studios and networks are very much on the line of downloading is bad, illegal piracy is bad, we do not support this at all. HBO has been surprisingly polite, if not kind, about the illegal downloads. You had HBO's programming chief, Michael Lombardo, saying a couple of weeks ago that his bigger concern wasn't that people were downloading, but that by downloading they'd get an inferior product.
Now, last year, didn't a number of HBO fans say that they wish they could somehow purchase only this show?
Currently, if you want to stream HBO content online, you have to sign up for the cable channel. There was an online campaign called Take My Money HBO that was essentially, we'd love to stream the shows, we'd like to pay for this, but we don't want to sign up for a cable subscription. Can you offer something else? And HBO has teased the option, before. They've said maybe if we can get the math correct, but they've never really come out and said this is something we're interested in.
In their view, would it undercut the programming of other series it was creating?
Their concern is in order to stay competitive with other streaming services, they would have to have a low price point for streaming, which would undercut the cable subscription.
Does all this piracy ultimately hurt the network itself?
I'm not sure it does. I think it really raises the profile of the show and raises the profile of HBO in general. One of the HBO directors for Game of Thrones, a guy called David Petrarca, actually said, no, it's great. It really helps the show's cultural buzz, and it does not impact the bottom line because HBO has more than enough money to keep making the show. So what this is this makes HBO the center of a cultural conversation about illegal downloading, about streaming content, about the production of content and distribution of content, which is probably somewhere they really want to be.
That's Graham McMillan. He's a writer for Wired.com. Well, Graham, I'm going back to Winterfell. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Time now for today's bottom line in business. We're taking a look at an idea that's getting more popular in this country, car sharing. The basic business model has been around for more than a decade, but new companies and concepts are emerging and expanding. Car2Go is one company that seems to be benefiting from the changing way we use cars. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports that car sharing could reflect a shift in what cars say about us.
David Stewart doesn't own a car. Instead, the managing partner of a small social media company relies on Car2Go for getting around. He picks one up first thing in the morning in his neighborhood and drives to the local coffee house. He works for a couple of hours, and when he's ready to visit a client, he grabs another, which he finds on an app on his smartphone.
And these are the closest Car2Go's, and you see the little Car2Go icon there. There's one right across the street, so I'm just going to tap on that. And now it's held for me.
We walk about 100 feet to the tiny two-passenger smart car.
I'm going to go ahead and swipe my card across the screen. And now it's confirming my account. And you wait until the car is unlocked. And now we can get in and start driving.
The idea is simple. Customers like Stuart take a car when they want it, drive it anywhere within the company's designated area, and then just leave it. They might drive 3 or 4 different cars in a day, but pay only for the time they actually use them, 38 cents a minute or 14 bucks an hour for a longer trip. For Stuart, it all works out to about $150 a month, a fraction of what a car payment plus gas, parking, and insurance would be.
Oh man, I don't even want to think about that.
It's truly a flexible on-demand service for our customers.
Nicholas Cole heads up North American operations for Car2Go. He says it's not just 20 and 30-somethings or college students who are using the service. So are retirees who've moved into the city and given up an automobile.
Seattle is a great example. I mean, you know, we launched right before Christmas. And, you know, here we are in April with over 18,000 people have signed up.
Nationwide, they claim about 90,000 members. Across the country, about 10 times that many are using established car sharing services, according to Susan Shaheen, an expert in sustainable transportation at the University of California, Berkeley.
What a lot of people are starting to see is the emergence of a lot of different companies and a lot of competition.
She says Zipcar was the first company to gain attention for renting out cars on a short-term basis. More recently, a company called Drive Now, like Car2Go, offers one-way options. And says Shaheen,
now we see things like peer-to-peer car sharing, where you can actually put your own personal vehicle into a car sharing system.
Shaheen counts 12 personal car sharing companies in North America as of last month. There's no question that economics are driving the car sharing market, but environmental concerns and the adaptation of smartphone technology are factors too. So are cultural changes, says Jeffrey Tumlin of the transportation planning firm Nelson Nygaard.
People of my generation believed that our private automobile said a lot about who we are, that defined our power and our status. The younger generations don't seem to be buying into that anymore, and they're seeing automobiles as simply a tool.
It's hardly surprising, then, that automakers see car sharing as a potential new market. Daimler-Benz owns Car2Go. BMW's offering is Drive Now. Volkswagen and Ford are exploring the market, too. Back in Seattle, David Stewart is about to end his current trip. He breezes into a parking spot, closes the windows, and sets the parking brake.
And it'll automatically end the trip if you put the key in the spot.
Thank you, and we hope to see you again soon.
Mindy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
Okay, how about something delicious? Technical advances in the past decade have allowed Vermont maple syrup producers to triple the number of taps they're putting in maple trees. This means more syrup. It also means more money. Last year, maple syrup produced $40 million in revenues in Vermont. That's double the amount from 6 years ago. Melody Baudette of Vermont Public Radio reports on the sweet taste of success.
When most people imagine maple syrup production, they think of buckets hanging from trees collecting sap. But these days, most of that sap is collected by pipeline and vacuum pumps. At this sugar house in Fletcher, Vermont, sap arrives in tanks on the back of huge trucks where it's pumped underground into tubs. J.R. Sloan's sugar house is a model of efficiency. Years ago, producers had to boil all of the water out of sap to concentrate the syrup. Now, sap is sent through reverse osmosis machines, which filter most of the water out before boiling begins. The result is pure Vermont maple syrup.
See what he's pulling off the rig right there? That's fancy. So that's our best product you can make. That's the highest money.
Sloan started out tapping 14,000 trees in the spring, even as he worked a full-time job. He was taking a chance when he built his sugar house.
That costed $117,000 to build that with all the equipment in it. The first year, I grossed $239,000. Syrup went wicked high that year. Got into it at just the right time.
And it's been up ever since. Now he buys sap from up to 95,000 trees, and he's left his old job behind. Sloan works on his sugaring business year-round, including tapping trees and running pipelines for other landowners. He hopes to make 32,000 gallons of syrup this year. Like most of the syrup made in Vermont, it will be sold in bulk. Sloan isn't alone in making maple his primary source of income. Vermont now has 3,000 commercial maple producers, up a third in just a decade. Even some dairy farmers who once sugared on the side have decided to sell the cows and focus on maple, like Cecile Brannon at Brannon Family Maple Orchards. When Brannon and her husband first started sugaring, they used horses and buckets.
We miss our horses and stuff, and that whole feeling of horses and the tradition. But to make it, to watch your labor and your time and efficiency, you've got to go with tubing with a mainline system.
Now the Brannons and two sons tap 66,000 trees. She says they bought over $100,000 worth of high-tech equipment to handle that volume of sap.
There's people that are getting into it feeling that this is a get-rich type of thing. It's not. The investments that you have to make are unbelievable.
And the sugar house has not only gotten bigger, it's been redone to meet food safety standards. They've switched to new taps that prevent the holes in trees from healing up, extending the season. Vacuum pumps also allow sap to flow, even as the spring weather that sugar makers depend on becomes less predictable. Weather and climate change will always be a concern, but even last year, when Vermont had 80-degree days in March, producers made more syrup than most previous years. For NPR News, I'm Melody Baudette in Colchester, Vermont.